welcome to The Middle. Conversations at the intersection of public relations, journalism, and marketing, where we talk about what's happening behind the scenes to tell and sell stories to audiences in North America and around the world. I'm your host, Sophie Natto, the National Media Lead at Edelman Canada. So, let's get that conversation started. Today, I'm joined by two of the smartest media geeks in North America, lucky me. Steve Rebell, Edelman's chief content strategist, is one of the leading experts on the evolving media landscape, and he's blurring the lines between traditional and emerging channels with his advice. He's advancing Edelman's thinking on the entire media ecosystem and helping clients develop new programs that blend paid, owned, and earned content strategies. He's also a diehard Yankees fan.
Correct.
Hey, Steve.
Hello.
We won't hold that against you. We're in Toronto, so thank you for coming.
14 games back.
And Matthew Ingram, the chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review. Before he was with Columbia Journalism, he was at Fortune Magazine and GigaOM,
is that right?
Yeah, GigaOM, yep. Writing about the evolution of traditional and social media, and he's a Canadian who's also worked at the Globe and Mail, which is a daily national newspaper here in Canada based in Toronto. He was the Globe's first communities editor, helping it make it easier for readers to connect to the brand online. So, hey, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what I'm hoping we can do today is unpack those key trends that everybody needs to know about. So what are you obsessed with right now, Steve? What's on your mind when it comes to the intersection between journalism, marketing, and public relations?
I'm obsessed with how people get their news and information and how that's changing and how that has created positive change, positive opportunities, new ways of communicating, new formats. But on the other side, created all kinds of issues, you know, some of which are intersecting with kind of, you know, larger topics and political issues. But I would say it's the ongoing tension between platforms and publishers and the dynamic that's created, where basically if you look at what's happened, you have a small group of companies that have, you know, technology companies that have inserted themselves between content creators and content consumers, and you know, notably Google and Facebook, but they're not alone there. But it's actually part of a much, much bigger story. And the bigger story is that, you know, any place where there is a lot of supply is being optimized through a handful of technology companies that are managing the demand on and making it easier for consumers to find exactly what they need in a very simple way. So let me pull that at a big level. So in information, you got, you know, Google and Facebook that are arguably, you know, one on a search-driven side and the other on a social side, modulating kind of what people see and what they don't see, you know, in a news context. But let's look at other things. You know, Netflix and Hulu in the U.S. and, you know, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, Amazon are, you know, controlling the flow of entertainment content and optimizing demand based on, you know, against supply, and that's creating disruption. Mm-hmm. In transportation, Uber and Lyft are optimizing demand based on consumption, making it easier for people to get exactly what they need and when they need it. In travel, Airbnb is doing that. So there's a bigger arc in that, you know, and the bigger narrative that sometimes people I find forget is that, you know, technology is A, reducing friction between buyer and seller, and in media and news, that is consumer and publisher. Mm-hmm. And so that dynamic to me is super interesting because it's part of a bigger trend that is creating incredible benefits in many cases for the consumer. I mean, news, it's questionable if that's created benefits. But in other industries, it's created amazing benefits. And so that is kind of the bigger arc. And looking at that and trying to unpack what that means in not only in a communications perspective, but in the business perspective too.
But yeah, Matthew, that's created definitely some losers too, right? So this environment that Steve's talking about, so how do you see the world right now?
I mean, I would say I'm concerned about the same thing Steve is. You know, because I'm in media, I don't, like Uber, I think is cool. I like to use it. It doesn't really affect me. I'm not a cab driver. But the way that Facebook and Google and Twitter impact how people get information and what information they get is, I think, the single biggest issue, not just for news companies who are having their whole revenue model disrupted, but for people in general, for mm-hmm. how society gets its information. And I think there has never been in history an entity like Facebook. There has never been a company that large run by effectively a single guy with 2 billion people using it for information, getting a view of the world that is shaped fundamentally by that company. The algorithm in particular, the way that it filters information, the way it decides what to show you and when to show it to you, that's fundamentally an editorial function. Mm-hmm. And yet it's being performed by this black box that's run out of, California by a bunch of 20-somethings.
It feels like the lines used to be very clean, right? Between news and information, and we knew sort of where we were getting our stuff
And they're
from.
Not anymore. They're not even close. Like, everything is blurring into everything else. Everything is a media company. People used to make fun of me because I said, still do, because I said, everything is effectively a media entity.
Yeah.
Like, every company, every service, every product, every person, anybody with a phone, anybody with internet access. Mm-hmm. And that's good, right? Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, that's good. Mm-hmm. It's good to get information from different sources. It's good to have variety. It's good. It's fundamentally good if you care about journalism as journalism, not just journalism as a business or journalism as kind of media, but the flow of information. To have those tools is good, but they have a massive downside.
Like, if you think about, Steve, how much things have changed. When I left the newsroom 10 years ago, I was a black pariah. Like, I was completely shunned. I was told I was going to the dark side, that PR could never actually deliver journalism or content in a way that was helpful for people. You know, fast forward 10 years later, content is not just something that's being done in newsrooms, right? I mean, talk a little bit about some of the change that you're seeing and how story moves through some of these platforms.
Well, I mean, it is a democratized environment on one hand, but it's not, it technically is a level playing field, but it kind of isn't, because while content is king, distribution is King Kong.
Yeah.
It's the people who really understand the new dynamics of distribution and adapt their content accordingly are ones that are going to succeed. In many ways, many brands, many companies are new to content creation, and they're worried more about the art and not worried enough about the science. And when I say the science, I really mean social science, right? Social psychology and understanding, talking to clients, for example, about what questions are you trying to answer in Google that aren't being addressed by somebody else that you could answer, with authority. What types of communities are engaged on your topics? Where are they engaged? And how do you activate subject matter experts in that environment? So on the one hand, it's democratized, it's open, but audience development, which is a phrase used in media a lot, remains, I think, one of the grand challenges of our time, because... And, the marketers have an out, or I guess you would, guys would say an oat.
An oot. Yeah.
An oot. Okay.
An oot.
But the marketers have an out in that they always can pay for distribution.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They can always pay.
That's right.
Now, I haven't met a marketer, and I meet a lot of marketers every year. I'm very fortunate to do that, but... who wants to spend more today than they spent yesterday.
Sure.
Everybody
wants to spend less.
And, right. But, they always have that, and the media companies don't have that. But I also find the media companies...
They can on Facebook.
But they also have, in many cases, fewer resources.
Right.
Because of
Facebook.
so we often talk about like the key commodities in this world is time,
attention,
and trust.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we accept that that's the baseline, right?
We don't have enough of any of them.
No, well, this is the thing. And so everybody's jockeying for position right now. Everybody's fighting for real estate, whether it be brands and companies and newsrooms. And we're all trying to figure out the audience, in these tiny little verticals, right? What I'm really curious about is, what is this doing to audience behavior? Because we have stats that show like 54% of Canadians are disengaged from the news, checking it less than once a week. So
and
what
let's
is
face it, like
people?
one of the big downsides of all this democratized information and so on is overload, right?
Right.
I mean, I feel it, and it's not just because I'm in the industry. I think lots of people feel it, and it's not just news, it's everything. Every marketing information, political information, cultural information, it's just there are so many more sources than there used to be. You know, before maybe there were like three channels on TV and there was like one radio program and there were two newspapers. So information overload wasn't really a huge issue. But now it's literally everywhere, and it's all the time.
So what
and
we're
filtering
seeing.
It is the hard part. So Facebook actually provides a service. It filters the information for you. But it's also excluding things, and you don't know what or why.
Hmm. You know, again, another big story is that we went from relative information scarcity to total information abundance. And so what that's done, and so that's created, and you know, anytime you go from a little of something to a lot of something in a short amount of time, I don't care if it's food, money, love,
massive
you know,
problems.
It's just all kinds of, it just creates all kinds of changes and behavioral changes. So we went from, you know, I mean, we went, if you look at a 25-year arc, I mean, yeah, okay, you went from real information scarcity, but even in a 10-year period, went from, you know, a huge leap in the amount of content. So one of the issues within that is quality. Right, because not everything is going to be of the highest quality within that. Because then you have the you know the people who are controlling the flow of information, you know, so to speak, Facebook, Google, etc. So how does that change? I think it's how does abundance of information and you know
to me the big thing, the big sort of trust is a massive kind of way in which people find their way through that sort of overabundance, right? They pick people or sources that they trust. In many cases, this is, I think, part of the disruption for media. People don't have to choose a media outlet anymore. So they don't have to go and read this or that or listen to this or that media outlet to get information. They can pick anyone,
right?
Anyone on Twitter, anybody, people they've literally never heard of, people whose names are just jokes and their avatar is a picture of a dog or something. But if they trust that person, that person becomes a source for them, an information source. And that's an incredibly powerful thing.
So two quick things in that. One is individual-based. I think you're going to see that be as a theme, right? Because social media was not really built for institutions to communicate. We use it, and it's for that, and it's done a great job of that, but it's really built as an individual medium.
Right.
And you know,
it works because it's social.
Right. So and subject
institutions
matter,
are not
so
social.
Finding subject, and then the other one is vertical, niche, narrow. Is the other thing that you're going to see is that the media landscape is not going to be as many monolithic be all things to all people.
But I think there's a social risk there that I'm concerned about. So niche makes sense from a whole bunch of perspectives, including business perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's much more profitable to go after a niche and serve it well. And I think there are media models that do that extremely well. But from a social perspective, if everything is niches, where is the kind of, you know, common wheel? Where is the kind of social broad perspective that people used to share to some extent that allowed them to talk about issues in a similar way, or at least to share information?
Like we're all in our filter bubbles.
Right. And if we have no shared facts or no shared kind of perspective, then it's really, really hard to have civil discussions.
Well, so this is where I think Apple is an interesting company because they have news editors that are programming the news editor's choice in the top sections in there. And if you are in any way an Apple News user, you're exposed to those sections that are managed by editors. And they are saying everybody in some way needs to at least see this headline.
Right. And that is an interesting perspective as opposed to an algorithm. But
there's an algorithm there, too.
The Tao Center just came out with a report that showed that most of the Apple choices come from a very limited number of major media brands. So that's great, except how does that help anybody find local brands?
Yeah,
or,
and then add to that misinformation, right? So how does that throw everything into a tizzy?
I mean, misinformation, the problem that I think lots of places are having is that misinformation is not an either-or black-and-white thing, right?
Right.
There's clear fakes, and there's clear things where people just invented stuff that doesn't exist. But the really hard part is the stuff in the middle,
right,
where people take things that are factual and blow them out of proportion or use them to represent something that they don't actually represent. Mm-hmm. Media organizations do that too.
Right.
You know, spinning a story is something that media organizations do all the time. And at some point, if you spin it too much, it crosses over into misinformation.
So it's interesting because I often hear that this is the sole responsibility of journalists. Sorry, and actually, you know, it's interesting, Steve. Right? Like, it should be a bigger pie, right?
It's increasingly all these problems have to be solved by a kind of a coalition of media, government, business, and to some degree, nonprofits or academics who are active in this area. So in the misinformation area, part of it is if there's a void, and something is not being filled with quality information, incredible information, something else will rush in to fill the gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now I tell clients that
nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes.
I have to write that down. You're too smart.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
I don't even know what.
So if there's a vacuum of information, something will fill it.
Or as Richard Edelman often says, silence is a tax on the truth.
So if you don't feel that, what I tell clients, if you're not actively putting your story out there and your content out there,
someone else will put your story out there.
It doesn't have to be through your own channels. It could be through third parties. Something else will fill it. Competitor. But also rumors that become trumors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that they are accepted facts.
But I think the thing that you didn't mention that is interesting is there's a real responsibility, I think, that individuals have, that we all have as information consumers. We can't wait for Facebook or the government to solve a misinformation problem. This is something that we engage in ourselves all the time. When we retweet something that sounds really salacious or interesting, and we don't check to see if it's true because fundamentally we don't care. It's just, it's interesting or it's funny or it's about someone that we don't like. And so we retweet it. That, every time you do that, you're like adding a little drop to that ocean of misinformation.
So conscious consumption
is
an important theme. Just again, it's look at eating.
Right.
And how people are.
And that's how I think of it too, a diet.
Right.
You know,
right.
You think if you're trying to be conscious about what you're eating, you're thinking about where does it come from and who's involved in it and is it something that I can defend if someone were to say, you know, and information I think you have to look at the same way.
Yeah, I agree. I guess my issue is that we're media geeks. We're not normal news consumers, I think what's interesting is often when I listen to news programs around content and around journalism and PR, you know, we're kind of talking to ourselves a lot of the time, and I'm wondering, like, how do we reach that 54% of disengaged people?
I mean, that is a huge question that I wrestle with all the time. We, especially when it comes to things like fact-checking and sort of media initiatives that are very well-meaning, aimed at sort of fighting misinformation. I love all that because I am a media geek. And I think, but the impact that that's going to have on regular people is infinitesimal.
Yeah.
So how can you convince someone who's getting most of their information from Facebook and their crazy uncle shared some conspiracy theory from Breitbart or Reddit or whatever, how do you convince them to not do that or to not believe that or to check something? That's a really, really hard problem. These are cultural problems and fundamentally human psychological and sociological problems. These are not technological problems that you can fix with like an algorithm tweak or something.
You have to create a reward structure. So what social media has done really well is created this reward structure for sharing.
Right.
I mean, some people
criticize it.
Evan Spiegel from Spiegel, is that how you pronounce his name, from Snapchat.
Yeah.
He has said that Facebook, you know, has created a reward structure where you're competing with your friends.
Totally agree.
So there has to be some sort of alternative reward mechanism that's built in. So where is that? It's not financial. It's a social identity payoff.
Right. Could we make it? Someone said to me, could we make it as socially unpalatable or unattractive to share misinformation as it is to smoke?
That's right. That's it. I've used
a
similar.
That's a really hard thing to do. Like you, need,
it's happened. Look at smoking.
It has
I mean, in the United States. Yeah. I mean, you see some smoking.
I think it's more obvious how smoking is bad for you. It's not obvious how misinformation is bad for you. Like, so you shared some funny story that isn't true. So what?
Right.
And the thing that's hard about it is Facebook does. It is an engine for distributing information. Period. Facebook doesn't care whether it's true or not. Like, they pretend they care because...
Well, they're
going to
care. I think they're going to care more because of...
They're going to have to care. Yeah. But fundamentally, all they care about is you spend time on there, you click on things, and you share things with your friends. And what makes you do that? Jonah Peretti at BuzzFeed said, what makes you do that is you feel a strong emotion. Not truth is not an emotion.
Right.
We've
quoted him a few times this week here. There has to be another kind of incentive. So what, you know, this is a classic carrot and stick problem, right? So if sharing misinformation, if there's a stick around that, no, but maybe there's a carrot for like finding misinformation.
And
actually
one of the interesting areas I think is there are lots of experiments going on with the blockchain, for example, using cryptocurrency to incentivize certain kinds of behavior. Is that going to work? I have no idea.
Money's always been
an
incentive.
Kind of
money's never
it's
fails.
Kind of interesting.
But it does start at the platform level, but
But we can't rely on them.
It's a human problem.
We have research that does show, at least in Canada, about 16% of consumers are willing to actively engage in sharing and talking to people about content, whether it be news or other kinds of content. And the research shows us that when those people engage, they bring in some of the disengaged, right? And they're doing it because they want to, you know, do good in the world. Sometimes they have an opinion and want to share it, right, Steve? But I mean, there is a small group of people who can be weaponized maybe to change some of this. I mean,
or they could become evangelists that you could sort of help. They could help you or help information delivery systems become better. But those people are not going to solve the problem. You have to reach the unreachable, or you have to reach the people who are so entrenched in their filter bubble or so entrenched in their love of Breitbart and Fox News that you have to find some way of reaching them. And I think the only way to do that is to understand what is driving them.
Right.
You can't just, because there's lots of sociological and psychological research to show the more, if you don't trust me, if you come from some other perspective, the more I argue with you and try to convince you you're wrong, the more you believe you're right. Actually making the problem worse instead of better. How do you get past that?
I think sometimes we try to, or at least the way the industry talks about this, we try to solve this as a universal problem. Like we have to get everybody to do this. All these people have to do it. And it's not. It's increasingly thinking about who are the movable middle.
Right.
Because people, this classic, again, this is a social science problem.
There's people who will never shift.
They never shift. They're on either edge. I mean, and digital is so polarizing in so many ways, right? Left and right, right? You know, meat lovers and vegans, Android and Apple. I mean, it's everything, you know, Yankees and Blue Jays, I'm gonna say. Okay? So it's designed to be a polarizing, push you into your passions.
And I think platforms like Facebook
newsrooms too. Like everybody's making content.
It's not about you can't. There's just certain people. You know, some of it is like religion. You're not going to turn a Jew into a Christian and vice versa. It's not going to happen. So, but there's people in the middle of everything, and it's increasingly saying how do we get at least enough people to consider that there's an alternative of something.
But part of what we talked about before is going to fight against that. If you are trying to become more niche, let's say your business model is moving towards subscription, like a lot of media companies are, you're going to pitch to the choir, right? You're going to be preaching to people who already love you, who already agree with you about certain things. There's zero economic incentive for you to reach out to people who don't agree with you. Mm. So then it can entrench things even further because now your business depends on it.
But does there become a social? Is there a social network or something that comes along with an incentivized way of getting people to look at information?
Maybe. I mean,
or does somebody start to dabble in that and say, okay, is there? I mean, you know, look at like Groupon, how they created a different model. They took this. So I'm wondering if there's somebody who's going to come along and do that. Now we could argue like, well, how are they going to get scale? Is that really going to happen? And in some markets,
that's a whole separate conversation.
Right, in some cases, the government is going to do things, right? On U.S., probably not.
Maybe we should have a government-funded social network.
Oh my goodness! Okay, so
that
so
won't.
Now,
I don't think anybody would work over that. But there are. I mean, just quick last thing is. I mean, look at in China that you are. There are. I mean, China's an extreme, but there are systems there where you're standing on social networks, you know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, your standing goes down.
Determines whether you get current
based on your credit rating.
An episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah, it's like they looked at Black Mirror and thought, that's a great idea. We should do that.
Right.
So with the time that's left, I would like to do two things. I would like to paint a picture of the future a little bit. Like, we're talking about some really complex problems. We sort of come up against the idea of nudging people maybe towards some positive change to make the ecosystem a bit healthier. So tell me, what do you think the future will or should look like? And then we'll look a little bit about what you miss about the past.
Future how? Which it's a big topic.
Well, future in terms of
flying cars,
like media and content. And we're talking about how humans are overwhelmed by content, by the idea that there's just too much of it, that there's a lot of competition, people being pushed into verticals, which is creating filter bubbles and maybe making things worse. So, you know, what is it about the business of content and media that's going to shift over the next few years to possibly make things better or worse?
You know, even though I know, Matthew, you're a little concerned about the money, but I think the verticalization of things and much more sophistication about audiences and building relationships with a very, very finite group of people. Now, that will happen, I think, more in B2B and you know, and in high value information sectors more quickly. But in, I mean, look at how many media companies are starting to again focus on research. Not a new idea. I mean, when I worked in trade media 20 years ago, I remember it was research events and advertising. But I think you're going to see that B2B is going to happen first. In consumer, it's going to be tough, but it's going to be a focusing on high interest vectors, right? High interest vectors. And not just sports, but, you know, super hyper-local sports. I mean, maybe even high school sports in some cases. You know, not just food, but, you know, I mean, I don't know anything about food. Vegan, fusion.
Right.
I don't know. You guys will tell me.
The niche of niche, basically, is what you're
right.
saying.
Right. And understanding and having a multi-pronged business model within that, which is some advertising, because it's not going to – duopoly in the United States is huge, so it's not your
– Do you think the duopoly is immovable, an immovable force that will never change?
I think it's going to be moved. I think the government
is going to do
something.
The data story is part of that. It depends on the data.
I think there's going to be regulation.
And also the data. The data is directly related. So, right. So I would say vertical, narrow, and instead of, like, you know, covering monolithic topics like tech or covering monolithic topics like, you know, like food or it'll be in those passion areas, but little smaller finite slices of that. And I think the media companies having a portfolio of those companies to hold them and put them together. And the other thing also I would say related to that is many more unholy alliances, meaning many more media companies working with other media companies that they would never work for. I mean, you see a whole bunch of media companies partnering now with Vox Media on, I think, Concert, is that mm-hmm. what it's called? So there's, you know, there's they realize that, you know, that if they group together, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Is that this for saying, or did I just totally get it wrong and I have to go back to school?
I mean, so what do you think is going to happen?
I think there's probably going to be an increasing, I mean, my feeling is that this is a great purification that we're mm-hmm. seeing. There's going to be tons of things that just die, period. There's
like going what?
To be media companies.
Media companies, like who?
Well, I don't want to name any names, but
I don't think we do either.
There are some that are weak that are getting weaker,
gotcha.
And they're going to fail.
Okay.
Or they're going to be acquired at tiny sums by someone else who will then fail. Like, I think there's a kind of massive purging of media companies that made sense during a specific time, and when that time is over, and so they just can't adapt. They're like the dinosaurs or something. But then the thing that interests me are the ones that are either starting from scratch, you know, it's one guy, or it's The Information and it's maybe five or six people and now they're hiring more, or it's The Athletic and they've found something, a voice, an audience, the people who trust them, people who search them out. And they're going to be able to monetize that in ways that other companies could only dream of, whether it's events or newsletters or, you know, research or subscription products. But that's the magic. Like, so we're getting beyond the point where just having a website or some specific tech was going to help you. Now I think you really have to be thinking about who is your market. Yeah. And that has become so much more important than it used to be, because if you serve them properly, they will love you and pay you. And if you don't serve them properly, they will be gone and your business will disappear.
I think mm-hmm. we're saying the same thing. There's also a layer of personality within that. You know, voice is
right.
critical.
Right.
But even when I say vertical, I mean exactly what you were saying. Mm-hmm. Like personality driven, where, you know, it's reaching a very yeah. finite audience.
And the opportunity for those things is larger than it's ever been.
Right.
It's just harder than it's ever yeah. been as well.
It's a cruel
and audience. We'll all be very comfortable in our little... in our little bubbles, right? Our
hopefully
niches.
Not too comfortable.
So one last question before I let you guys go. Okay, we've talked a lot about the future and about what's happening right now. You know, change has been so rapid over the last 10 years. I was hoping you could sort of tell me what you miss about the olden days, which, you know, the olden days, to be clear, wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. It's like we're 150 years old. What
you
do
guys are super
remember?
Old.
About,
yeah.
You know,
do you remember
I'm
when
only
we had
10
no
years
cell
old.
Phones?
I don't
the
really.
Turn of the century. Do you remember what that was like?
I mean, you guys remember when we didn't have like
we didn't have
smartphones.
Cars and, yeah.
And, yeah, right? Yeah. You're old enough to remember yeah. that. So, Steve, what do you miss about the olden days?
You know, I might be... I don't like to look back, to be honest. I you know, the past is the past, and I can't do anything about it. And I really don't like to reminisce about it because it's gone. I can't do anything about it, and I have to live for today. and think about where I am right now, right here, right now. So I'm more zen about it. You know, I would say that the only thing I might miss is that there are. I do miss the a little bit the personalities of news that I knew I would always turn to. So I had an opportunity about a year ago to meet. We did some events with Dan Rather, and you know, and I was with him, and I was like, when our CEO was with him, and we were standing there, and I was like, wow, this guy. I was thinking back to all these different events that he was at, right? And there's not a lot of those people who are witness to history in every way. So this week is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in the United States, and you know, and you look back at the people who were around for that, and they're not there, and also others who were there have been taken down by some significant scandals. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit miss the newsman or woman who was at everything. I mean, you know, I watch old videos of, you know, sometimes we went to the 9/11 museum. I've been there, and you see the Peter Jennings, and you're like, wow, it was like it was a voice that you turn to that voice, but for the most part, I try to look. Look, I try to live in the now because I think I need to and a little bit of the next, but I can't go back to that, so I don't really spend a lot of time reminiscing.
What about you, Matthew?
I guess I miss, this is related, but I miss the sort of individual voices that you could find yourself instead of waiting for them to show up on Facebook. I miss when Twitter was a simpler place with not as many trolls, and I miss the sort of innocent times in a way of, you know, a bunch of people had blogs and they were smart and you went and read them and you linked to them and they linked to you and you've had conversations on Twitter. Like that stuff is just not possible anymore. And the platforms have taken so much power and kind of disintermediated in a way that we're now in a place where you've got these giant entities control effectively so much of how information works. It's no longer just the open web and you wander around and find whatever. And I do kind of miss that.
Well, I appreciate both of you guys coming in today to talk about this. And you've given us a lot to think about. So thank you. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can find all of us on Twitter. Steve's at Steve Rebell, Matthew is at Matthew I, and I'm at Sophie Natto. You can find more about Edelman's work online at edelman.ca.